We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order. Senator Lynch, how would you like to be first?
Like that.
Senator Lynch has Senate File 3187.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To begin with, I have the A1 amendment just to put the bill in its proper form.
Council, what does the A1 do?
Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment would change the effective date so that it would be for all of 2007 rather than starting in 2008. Apparently, there were purchases made in 2007.
That's the in total?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble moves the A1. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are here today to talk a little bit about a project from Rochester Public Utilities that provides steam to the Mayo campus. And in doing so, the Mayo campus was able to reduce medical costs by $40 million in capital investments and an annual savings of $2.5 million in operating costs. This is a steam supply project. It's between two nonprofit organizations, the City of Rochester and the Mayo Foundation. We are here today seeking a sales tax exemption on pollution control equipment. This provides incentive to purchase and install such equipment to provide cleaner air in Minnesota. When this proposal, when Rochester Public Utilities first came to me, one of the things that I certainly became aware of and noticed was the existing statutes currently that have exemptions for steel processing, wind energy, conversion systems, waste processing equipment, and others. And as pollution control is an integral part to power generating systems and is part of the overall production, I was pleased to bring this forward. I'm keenly aware of the budgetary restraints that we are working under, but, Mr. Chair, I would suggest to you that as much as the incentive is for the overall production that we're trying to work on, this really represents some good, strong public policy. And I have with me today two officials from Rochester Public Utilities. And at this time, Mr. Chair, I'd ask Walter Schlenk, the Director of Power Resources, to make a few additional comments.
Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to come and speak with you this morning on a subject we think is very important. As Senator Lynch said, Rochester Public Utilities is a...
If you could, your name and who you represent for the record.
Sure. Walter Schlenk, and I am the Director of Power Resources for Rochester Public Utilities. Rochester Public Utilities is a department of the City of Rochester, Minnesota.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. This project got started, as Senator Lynch mentioned, by a energy supply contract we put in place with the Mayo Clinic. Very proud of the benefits that we've offered to the clinic. As was mentioned, we've reduced the capital investment the clinic had to make by about $40 million, and there will be an ongoing benefit of about $2.5 million and growing going forward. We think it's critical. We don't think many other organizations have made that kind of impact on reducing the health care costs for the state. We're also very proud. They just released their 2007 performance. Mayo Clinic added 1,000 new jobs in the City of Rochester last year, and we think we're a significant contributor to that kind of economic success. The project of providing steam caused us to have to reopen our environmental permits And as part of that process, we got into negotiations with both the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and Minnesota Citizens for Environmental Advocacy. We then agreed to environmental reductions out of the Silver Lake plant of SO2, NOx, particulate, and mercury. And that was well greeted by our citizenry. They're very happy to see us taking a proactive pollution reduction activities. What we did not realize is pollution control equipment was specifically exempted under the production equipment exemption on capital purchases. We have started this project. The project began at the beginning of 2007. We are looking at a purchase of somewhat over $13 million in equipment purchases to be installed, an overall project value of about $37 million. And the problem with us as a municipal is we have no way of treating this tax other than just to pass it directly to our ratepayers. Our ratepayers will pay this tax on an in-use. They pay sales tax on the electricity they purchase from us. The way the current statute is listed, we'll pay the sales tax, we'll roll that into the rate, and then the consumer will pay the sales tax again on the retail sale. So we don't think that that's an equitable way of dealing with this. We think it is integral with production equipment. We think it should be included as a production exemption and allow the retail purchase to be taxed. What else do we have on here? It was also mentioned the Mayo activity, at least, is a nonprofit to a nonprofit. The other issue I guess we would bring up is, as a municipal, it's a political subdivision paying sales tax on production equipment to a political subdivision. It's the state and the city. We don't support that as we think good tax policy. I guess that's probably the length and breadth of it, and we thank you very much for taking the time to hear our position on this, and we strongly encourage your support of Senate File 3187.
Thank you, Mr. Schlenk.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lynch.
Mr. Chair, Susan Parker with Rochester Public Utilities.
Do I need to state your name again? Susan Parker with Rochester Public Utilities. Yesterday, in working with Mr. Ellerby from the Department of Revenue, he had put in the explanation of the bill that we believe that we would be reimbursed in 2009. And after that point, we figured out that the project will not be complete until May of 2009. And by the time we close out the contracts, it's very possible that we would not be asking for the refund until July or August of 2009 into your next biennium. So I thought that was important to pass along.
Thank you. Senator Lynch, any further testimony?
Mr. Chair, no further testimony. I would just once again just reiterate that this bill would exempt pollution control equipment purchased by a government subdivision, and as a matter of policy, think that that's a very good direction to go.
Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I heard a couple of numbers, and I didn't have a fiscal impacts note here, so I don't know if it's in there. Was the entire $36 million going to be exempt, or you talked about $14 million?
About $13 million. So the impact is about $860,000.
Great, thank you. I have a note now.
Any other questions for Senator Lynch? Is there Senator Lynch?
Mr. Chair, if I could, it's not often that I I do spend a lot of my time working in the healthcare arena, but I think this is an excellent example of how the two divisions certainly can overlap, and this is a way, as we are looking to curtail costs within the healthcare system, this is an excellent example of a contributing factor. And with that, Mr. Chair, I have no further comments.
Anything else from members of the committee? Senator Lynch, thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 3187 for possible inclusion in the committee's bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Let's get out of the way. this could be.
Senator DeBolt, welcome to your committee, Senate File 3617.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 3617, which would simply extend a deadline for a biomass facilities exemption from personal property tax from January 1st of this year to January 1st of 2010. Mr. Chair, I have Kim Mabee here, who is one of the principals with the developer who's putting together this biomass facility project. He can explain why this date extension is being sought. I just need to say that it's been the subject of some intense public conversations, neighborhood interest as well. I think a positive step forward in progressive energy policy, and like Senator Lynch, she spends a lot of time in the healthcare committee. I spend a lot of time in the energy committee, and I think this is a good another good matchup of important policy initiatives. For folks who have some questions about the facility itself, it's important to know that this is going to be a net benefit to that neighborhood in terms of environmental and energy policy. It's going to take quite a bit of fuel oil that's being burned in the neighborhood offsite. It's going to allow for the traffic generation in the neighborhood to this specific site to be reduced, and it's going to be the best, highest possible technology for a wood-burning facility of its type in the country. With that, I'll toss it to Kim Havey, who's a principal with the developers who are putting this together.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is Kim Havey. I'm a principal of the development team of Candy Ojai Development Partners, and we are the developers and investors in the Midtown Eco Energy Renewable Energy Biomass Facility in Minneapolis. The Midtown Eco Energy Project provides an immediate opportunity to harness innovation and take action to create a local, balanced, renewable energy solution that supports neighborhood economies and the global environment. I'm here to seek your support for Senate File 3617, a personal property tax exemption for our renewable biomass combined heat and power project. As you know, this committee and legislature have approved over 20 personal property tax exemptions for new electric power plants across Minnesota. In fact, in recent years, no new plants have been built in our state without such an exemption. Several of these are renewable biomass energy projects. Our plant facility will produce 24 megawatts of electric power and provide district heating for important businesses in the neighborhood, including Abbott Hospital, the new Children's Hospital, and the Midtown Exchange Complex, home of the Alina headquarters. The facility will use urban wood waste in a chip form and will not use refuse-derived fuel or coal as its fuel source. The City of Minneapolis supports this project. In fact, the city placed the site up for a request for proposals. Candy Ojai Development Partners won that competition, and the Minneapolis City Council has proven its support for the project in three occasions with unanimous votes of support. The plant will be built with union labor and will provide ongoing union jobs. If you pass this exemption and it becomes law and we receive our final permit from the MPCA this summer, construction can commence this fall. You have previously passed this exemption. In this bill, we are merely seeking a date change to meet our new permitting and construction schedule. I welcome your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Havey. Any questions from the committee?
Well,
Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe I didn't hear it, or maybe you said it and I didn't hear it. Is this... You know, what was the rationale for the 2-year delay? I didn't pick that up, I guess.
The anticipated timeline for the air permitting process has been slowed down.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Senator Dibble.
Is Mr. Havey, is the draft EIS out?
Mr. Chair, we are in the process of an EAW, an environmental assessment worksheet, and that is not out yet for public comment, but it has been worked on since about January 15th. So we anticipate that will come out in sometime in April for a 30-day comment, and it probably has another 30 days before it goes to the MPCA Board of Commissioners.
Any other questions, members? Chair lays over Senate File 3617 for possible inclusion. Senator Dibble, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
This has got something small. Anybody here? Is rest here? Senator Ortman? Who from the department's going to help Senator Ortman? And members, Senate File 3665 is the governor's supplemental recommendations to the tax committee. Commissioner, welcome.
Welcome, Chairman.
Senator Ortman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, members. This morning, Senate File 3665 is the governor's tax proposal for 2008. The application begins in 2009. The overall impact of this bill is to raise funds, $41,675,000, to be allocated to the governor's budget. The governor raises funds in many ways, but there are also some allocations of funds within the bill. In particular, there are some military provisions in this bill allowing for a subtraction of certain income, including National Guard training, some pensions up to $30,000, and other military pay. There is one of the significant portions of this bill is the corporate franchise tax, as we had in the tax bill last year. There we are tightening up some of the foreign operating corporations provisions. That provision will raise $102 million in 2009, and then will continue raising funds in the out years, not at such a high pace. Another key provision of this bill is the reduction of the sales and use tax, and I think Minnesotans have seen the legislature raising that tax through several of the bills that have been passed through the legislature. The Legacy Act is a proposal to change that, increase it in the Constitution with the ballot question in November. But also the transportation bill included an increase in sales tax statewide and a potential sales tax increase in the metro area. The governor's proposal will cut 0.125% of that on a statewide basis, and that will save $76,800,000 in the first year, and it will continue, although those savings will be allocated to where those funds normally are allocated. So if you look at the second page of the revenue statement here, you'll see that those cuts get allocated to the Health Impact Fund, the Natural Resources Fund, the Game and Fish Fund, the Greater Minnesota Transit Account, and the County State Aid Highway Fund, to the extent that those funds were raised by the sales tax. Then we have proposed an increase in the accelerated payments from 80 to 85%. There are some jobsy and emerging business tax credits. I think the elimination of the political contribution refund is something the committee may want to look at. When it comes to property tax aids and credits, I think most people thought that we were going to be cutting local government aid. I think that the local governments will be pleased to see that the governor has not proposed that. There is a cut in the renter's tax refund from 19 to 16%. That follows along with the recommendations that have been made in reports to the legislature about cutting that. The recommendation was 15% or less. In this bill, the Department of Revenue has proposed a cut from 19 to 16% in that renter refund program. And that is a general outline of the bill. The Commissioner of the Department of Revenue, Ward Innes, is here to answer any questions that the members might have about that bill. And I know there are a series of people that might like to testify. But before we go further, Mr. Chair, if we could adopt the amendment that was prepared by Senate Counsel with some technical changes in this bill. The number is the A08-1320.
And Chairman, this amendment will pull out all the provisions that were passed in House File 3201 there's a lot of redundancies in here, and you took care of a lot of those issues in House File 3201. So this will clean up the bill and take out all those redundancies, and we won't have any those issues before the committee.
Council, is that all it does?
Mr. Chairman, there's just a couple of little additional. The first provision, the First Amendment on page 1, line 2, is just a clarification of the language relating to who is subject to this new provision. On lines 17 and 18, that relates to clarifying the impact of the transition aid for utility committees, communities, rather, and then there's the elimination of a purpose statement. But otherwise, all of the remaining sections are things that were, as Commissioner Ina said, in the bill that we just passed.
Senator Ortman moves the A08-1320 amendment. Technical in nature. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Chairman, I don't know what your preference is, but I'd be happy to go through quickly, try to go through section by section.
I think that
many
would be
of these provisions you're familiar with, Chairman and members of the committee. They're perennial favorites of the governor. So.
But I can go through there them. Were good ideas, they'd already be in law.
Sometimes persistence pays off. You've got to build a foundation over time. And then eventually the Senate may see the light. But we'll, so maybe that's what I'll do. I'll just go through the summary very quickly. And if you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask. Sections 1 through 8 is a new compliance tool that will help us facilitate the collection of tax debts. And it's modeled after something DHS currently has for child support payments. And essentially what it would do is that when we secured a tax lien, we would send the name, address, and social security number in an encrypted secured form to the financial institutions, and they would confirm whether that individual had an account at that financial institution. And a number of states have implemented a similar program and have had very good results. We expect this would collect an additional $10 million a year in outstanding tax obligations. I want to be clear, we would not use this for de minimis amounts, small amounts. Our general rule of thumb is that in order to secure a lien, it has to be at least $1,500 tax debt. So this would be for larger denominations. Sections 2, 3, and 4 is another proposal that I would classify as a compliance initiative. It would authorize the creation of a stamping office for surplus insurance lines. Currently, 15 states have established offices like this. This would be a nonprofit, non-governmental entity that would be exclusively funded by stamping fees paid by the surplus insurance lines. And I didn't know anything about surplus insurance lines until I started vetting this proposal. And essentially, those are the kind of insurance policies that you oftentimes can't secure in the admitted market and domestic market. They're things like insurance for hot air balloon rides and NASCAR races and amusement parks and terrorism insurance at times. Oftentimes, there's no insurer in the domestic market that offers that. And so you got to go out of state or non-domestic insurance market. This office would require that every piece of surplus line insurance that was sold here in Minnesota have to go to that office and get stamped. And then that stamping office would send to the Department of Commerce and the Department of Revenue a list of all the insurance that's been sold in the state. And then we could confirm that the appropriate amount of insurance premium tax is being collected on that insurance. States that have implemented a stamping office like this have been seeing increases in their insurance premium tax of somewhere between 25 and 300%. We're being conservative in our estimate here, and we're predicting about a 25% increase in insurance premium tax, which equates to about $3 million a year. And it'd be a nonprofit, once again, non-governmental entity that'd be established. And the Insurance Federation is supportive of this provision. The Surplus Line Association is supportive of this provision. We have not encountered any opposition so far in that provision.
Commissioner, I thought on the spreadsheet we were carrying about $1.5 million for this.
Chairman, that was the first year. I think the effective date is July 1st of this year. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe it's January 1st of next year. I'm sorry. That's the first half of a fiscal year. And then going forward, we expect to be about $3 million a year. Sections 5 and 47 relate to Job Z. And this is similar to a proposal that was in the vetoed bill last year that would extend the duration of the zone from 10 years from the time you entered the subsidy agreement. Actually, this proposes a bifurcated Job Z program. The general rule would be 10 years once you sign the subsidy agreement. for communities, for a city and a county that lost population from 1980 to 2000 or had an unemployment rate higher than the state average, they would get a 12-year duration for a job Z. So some of those more economic depressed areas would get 12 years. The rest of the state that was eligible would get a 10-year duration. It does not change the sunset date for this for job Z. Stays in effect 2015, but anybody who signed a subsidy agreement prior to that sunset date would get the full 10-year of job Z benefits. I also should mention there is another bill making its way. I'm sure you guys will hear it eventually. Maybe you already have it. Senator Rosen's bill in the Senate. I think it's Representative Marquardt's in the House that deals with many of the concerns of the OLA had and just tightening up the program, tightening up the reporting requirements, tightening up the penalties. And that's proceeding as a standalone vehicle. Section 6 and 28 is the Regional Emerging Business Investment Tax Credit. Similar to what was in the tax bill last year, kind of in concept and everything. I know in the interim there's been some work on this, and it is a little different than previous iterations. There are folks here from DEED that can comment more specifically if anybody has questions on that.
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, forgive me for interrupting, but going back to that job Z, the application to the numbers of businesses is actually quite small. 4 in 2009, 9 in 2010, and 12 in 2011. So I thought it was important we have the perspective of that very small number of businesses and areas that are affected in that extension.
Thank you, Senator. Section 7, 17, 19, and 53 all relate to the elimination of the political contribution refund. You know, we were making decisions about what to reduce in the budget. The decision came down between LGA or market value credit. The political contribution refund seemed like a logical place to go. So that eliminates the political contribution refund. Sections 9, 10, 9 through 4. I'm sorry.
Commissioner, we spend about $500 million a year on LGA. And what do we spend on the market value credit?
Chairman, it's about $6 million a year, I believe.
And the political contribution refund brings about $5 million. And somehow a $5 million program was in competition with LGA cuts?
Chairman, everything.
Which would have been a 1% cut in LGA.
Chairman, everything was in competition with everything. I mean, it really was. And there was a lot of hard decisions that had to be made. But I think this program, there's very few, if any, income tax credits the state has as a dollar-for-dollar refund up to a maximum of $100. It's to call it a tax credit is probably an overstatement. It's really a grant program. For legislators. So I think it's defensible to eliminate that rather than some other more valuable programs.
Commissioner, if somebody contributes to a gubernatorial campaign, are they eligible for it?
They are.
So it's not a program for legislators?
Public office holders, state public office holders. I stand corrected, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Sections 9 through 14 are the sections that pertain to the governor's proposed levy limit. And in most respects, this levy limit is similar to what has been proposed in the past, what we call traditional levy limits, with a couple of important distinctions. It applies to communities of 2,500 or more, which is traditional. So that would include all 87 counties, and I think about 224 cities would come under the purview of these levy limits. The levy limits would allow for increase in household and a CPI increase. You could exceed the levy limit if you took the issue to the referendum, to a referendum of your voters. So you could always have that escape valve and exceed the levy limit pursuant to a referendum. The two big distinctions here is that it's household growth plus the lesser of 3% or CPI. So it's tighter than past levy limits. And in addition, the levy limit base is not levy plus aid, it's levy. And the reason for making that change that the governor put this levy limit together from the perspective of the taxpayer, and he thought no matter whether you reside in an aid-dependent city or in a city that doesn't get any aid, you should be treated the same way. So the levy limit base is levy exclusively, not levy plus aid. But that's tighter than in the past.
So it's not a cap of 3% of a community's budget for a lot of communities.
That's correct, Chairman. And we thought that was a reasonable levy limit proposal. In the context of the fact that we did not cut any local government aid, we didn't cut market value credit, we did not cut county aids, I think if we had done that, I think there'd be a strong argument for at least allowing those communities to recapture that lost day. But since we held all those programs harmless, we thought this was a reasonable levy limit to put in place. To put this in some context, Chairman and members of the committee, if this levy limit had been in place for taxes payable in 2008, the 7.3% levy increase would have gone to 5.4. So I don't think this is an onerous or draconian levy limit. I think it provides for some growth in the levies, but also provides some protection to taxpayers in a time when they're really struggling with a lot of unanticipated economic costs.
But, Commissioner, it would be fair to say it would be more difficult for some communities than others.
Chairman, that would be a fair assessment. Section 16, 18, and 45 and 46 is a June accelerated payment. As we said earlier, the House File 3201 went from 78 to 80%. This takes it from 80 to 85%.
And, Commissioner, how high have we been? Have we ever been higher than 85?
I believe so, Chairman. Chairman, I think my memory is not great, but I think we've been up in the high 80s, 87, 88, maybe after the 2003 budget. I'd have to check with folks in the sales tax division, but I think we've been
can you check? Can you check and let us know?
I will. I will, Chairman. Sections 20, 24, 25, and 52 is the foreign operating corporation provision. This is identical to what was in the veto tax bill last year. Essentially, this is the language that Senator Pogomiller had worked on when he was tax chair. It raises about $102 million in the first year, and I think about $88 million every year thereafter. There's really no change. There's absolutely no change in this from what was in the bill that got to the governor's desk last year. Section 23 is the military pension and pay. Similar to what was been proposed in previous years, but this has a cap on it. This is only up to $30,000 phased in over 4 years. The earlier subtractions had been 100% of military pension and pay. So this is a phased back proposal. Sections 30 and 31 are the mutual fund, changing the way we apportion income for mutual funds. This was a proposal that was vetted in the conference committee. I think Representative Dabney had a proposal to do this. And it changes how we apportion mutual fund income. Currently, we apportion it to where the mutual fund is located. This would change, and we would apportion it based on where the customers are located. We think this provides more of an incentive for those mutual fund companies to be headquartered here in Minnesota. And it's a national trend we're seeing. We're seeing more and more states go in this direction. I know New Jersey, New York, California, some larger states, have gone to this apportionment methodology. Let me see. Section 32 has been removed from the bill. That's the 2% withholding on contractors. Sections 33 and 34, Chairman, are the adjustment to the renter's credit. This has been an issue that's been vetted in past legislative sessions. This recommendation is predicated on a Department of Revenue report that was issued in 2005. And that report found that the 19% of presumed rent was probably too high. Well, actually, was too high based on the data. And that the appropriate percentage is somewhere probably south of 15%. We've kind of compromised on that, and this is 16%. One thing, in the 2001 reforms, property tax reforms, one of the classes of property got the largest reduction in property taxes was apartment property, about a 24% reduction for the class, but we never recalibrated the renter's credit. So the renter's credit has been at 19% for the last 10 years. We think it's appropriate to reestablish the intent of this program, which is a property tax relief program. And right now, I think it can be persuasively argued, that this has become a kind of a hybrid program. It's part property tax relief, but it's also become a rent subsidy program. And so I think getting to the 16% gets closer to where the appropriate percentage should be.
Senator Spike. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Do you think there would be any value in updating that to 2007 or 8? Is there been any changes that would affect that, do you think?
Chairman, Senator Scully, that's a very good question, and we vetted that internally, and what we found is that rents have been fairly flat in the last 5 or 6 years. We're a little concerned about whether this data is antiquated, somewhat antiquated. I mean, it's 4 years old. We're confident that 16% is probably still above what it could be. I mean, I'll reacquaint you with the information. Our revenue survey, which went out to landlords, found the statewide average to be 11.7%. At that time, the commerce data, we had three data sets we used. The Commerce data found it to be 12.7%. And then the MHFA data, which is, of course, a different universe of buildings, it's Section 8, rent-restricted, found the percentage is less than 10%. So those populations that are probably most economically challenged are probably paying less than 10%. And they would still, under this proposal, get a fairly, I guess you could call it, healthy rent subsidy. So we think 16% is still above the statewide average. The other option, of course, is going back to where we were pre-97, which was where the landlord just apportioned it out to each renter, the exact amount they paid in property taxes. Now, from the landlord's perspective, that was a pain, difficult, and even from the department's perspective, it was administratively, difficult. But under that, you got an accurate reading of what everybody paid in property taxes, and you can reimburse them the appropriate amount. I think it makes sense to try to get this recalibrated to the right percentage.
Sir, go ahead.
And Mr. Chair, Commissioner, I was just looking at the 2005 bulletin, and I don't remember seeing those three breakdowns that you just talked about. Could I get information on that, please?
Absolutely, Senator. I'll give you that. Another point, I think, important fact in the report is that it did find that 91% of all the properties that were surveyed at that time had a percent of less than 15% or less, under 15%. So, 92%, 91% properties.
Thank
so
you.
We left a little bit of wiggle room with coming in at 16%.
Very good. Thank you.
The next sections, 38, 39, 40, 42, and 43, and 48, have all been removed because that's the streamlined conformity that was passed in House File 3201. Sections 41 and 44, Chairman, is a sales tax reduction that Senator Ortman talked about, 1/8 of 1%. That applies to the general sales tax. Does not apply to the motor vehicle sales tax. And the last sections of the bill, 49, 50, and 51, is the utility transition aid. And this proposal is identical to what the governor proposed last year, basically to try to provide a shock absorber to those communities that were more disproportionately impacted by the utility valuation rule change. So if you lost more than 5% of your net tax capacity, you would be eligible for this transition aid for a two-year period. We think this, in conjunction with the phase-in of the rule, at least provides a modicum of protection for those host communities.
Senator Squay.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Inez, to this, is that 5% decrease in revenues off of the same facilities, or if they've made changes or modifications to the facility that would have, without the rule change, actually been an increase in valuation? Is that factored in, or are we talking about different facilities here?
Chairman, Senator Scully, that is a very good question, which I may have to defer to somebody who knows more about this. I wonder if Eric Ouellette is here.
Oh, you
can. Yeah, let me.
You can get it to me.
Yeah, let me get that answer to you. I'm not exactly sure. But the way it would work is you've lost 5% of your tax capacity. You'd be eligible for this transition aid. And then the amount of transition aid you got would be anything in excess of 5% of your last levy plus aid. You get replaced dollar for dollar for that two-year period. But it is only temporary. It's transitioning.
And Mr. Chair, but Commissioner, if they doubled the plant size in the intervening time, that would be a question that should be looked at.
Senator Scully, we'll get an answer for you.
Senator Double.
Mr. Chair, if we could go back to the renter's credit.
Sure.
Mr. Inez, do you know what the average do you have a sense of an order of magnitude how much less renter credit the average renter would get? Or do we have some sense? I'm just curious what the impact is going to be on folks' budgets.
Right. Chairman, Senator Dibble, it would be about a 20% reduction, in a general rule of 20% reduction in the renter's credit. There were some people who would no longer be eligible for it, too. They get such probably a de minimis amount right now that they, under this reduction in the percentage, they would be knocked off it. I have those numbers here somewhere. I could actually provide those to you as a spreadsheet that would show you.
I'm most curious, getting down to the individual level, how much money we're talking about a family would have to absorb in their budget,
right?
Typically.
Yeah, Chairman, Senator Dibble, here's some better information. The average refund currently is $584 for renter's credit. Yeah, under this proposal, the average would go to 465, so about $119 reduction.
Thank you. Oh. Well, I see it's in our analysis here. I guess we have that in our packet.
Do you? Okay,
thanks.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Chairman, I believe that's the entire bill. The rest of it is just repealers in the van that we've already talked about.
Any further members? Commissioner? Senator Plugmaner.
Commissioner, is the... In your judgment, is the corporate franchise foreign operation corporation changes, is that a tax increase?
Well, and I'm not going to dodge that question. Chairman, Senator Plummer, I think it's reestablishing. I think it's a tax increase. I mean, I think it's reestablishing the original intent of the FOCs. And over time, I think people, I think they're legally within the confines of the current status of law, I think these corporations are. But I think we've all are second-guessing whether that was the original intent of the FOC provision. And I think the language we have in front of us reestablishes the original intent. It does raise revenue. It'll increase people's corporate tax obligations. I have a hard time calling that anything but what it is, tax increase.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Plugmaner.
Wonder, Commissioner, could your people, when we first suggested this change two or three sessions ago now, could someone in your office just put together a revenue note of how much money has been forgone since we did not implement it in the first instance?
Chairman, Senator Plugmaner, we could look into that, but I think it's worth remembering that this, what we have in front of us, is very different from the initial proposals that were introduced. So maybe it took 5 or 6 years to get to where we are today, which I think is a reasonable way of reestablishing the original intent of the FOCs. I mean, I think those original proposals that were introduced overcorrected for the problem. If there was a problem with how this was working in reality, I think it overcorrected. I think over time we've come to agreement about what the appropriate uses of the FOC, and I think the language that's in front of us today reflects that understanding.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pokemon.
Why don't you just calculate it as if this language had been implemented that first year?
We can do that, Mr. Chairman. Senator, we can do that.
Thanks.
Commissioner, if you can get that to me, maybe I'll get it distributed to the committee.
Okay, Chairman. I can answer your question about June accelerated and what was the high water mark. Actually, we've never been above 85%, I've been told. So this is kind of where we've high water mark for that.
Anything else?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Innes, can you explain how the sales tax reduction works? Is that statewide?
Chairman, Senator Larson, yes, it is. And it's just a reduction in the general sales tax rate. And that's, yeah, it's fairly straightforward. It's just a reduction in the general sales tax rate.
Commissioner, do you have any information? Is this about what kind of an economic stimulus this might provide? If that's what it's being proposed for, is there some kind of a multiplier we expect to see in economic activity because of the sales tax cut?
Chairman, I don't think the primary reason it was proposed was as an economic stimulus. I mean, we can see that it raises about, on average, about $87 to $90 million, it reduces taxes by about $87 to $90 million a year. In the context of $17 billion annual revenue stream, it's not a large amount. I think the primary reason for this being put in place was to mitigate the impacts of some of the tax increases that have already been passed this session and are pending either by constitutional question or by local authority. So I think it was more to try to mitigate some of the regressivity of the taxes that have been imposed already. And to put this in some context, the transportation bill included an income tax credit that I know a lot of people thought was an important piece of that proposal to try to mitigate the regressivity of some of the taxes that were being imposed. This reduction of 1/8 of 1% provides more than twice as much tax relief as that income tax credit did. So I think it's appropriate to try to maybe mitigate some of the things that have happened in the legislative session already. So it does provide, you know, twice as much relief as that income tax credit provides.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Innes. Isn't the net effect, though, if in fact what the governor is trying to do is to mitigate the impacts of the recent tax increase, doesn't this essentially spread the transit tax statewide? And that if you're isn't it possible to look at it that way? And I guess the second question would be why, when we're talking about recent tax increases, I know there's not been any discussion about the tax increase the governor signed as it related to the twins and the sales tax increase there. And I've been curious if in fact, you really want to talk about the impacts of recent tax increases, that's one that he certainly owns to some degree.
Well, first, Chairman Bach, Senator Larson, this is a tax reduction, so I guess I don't quite follow your logic on this spreads the transit tax statewide. This is a reduction in the general sales tax rate. That's all it is. To your point about the stadium bill that he signed, a very important feature of that stadium bill was that the county board would make the final decision to impose that tax. And he was merely providing, that legislation was merely providing the authorization for them to do that. And I do think times have changed since that bill has passed as well. I think, you know, the economic times have changed. Some of the things that the governor may have been supportive of in economic times were a little better. I think we're revisiting some of those. And I just think right now is just not an appropriate time or a good time to impose any additional taxes, even ones that may seem, you know, fairly nominal. And so I think this is a way of just saying, you know what, not just putting the brake on tax increases, but actually turning back the dial a little bit. I'll try to provide a little bit of relief.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogueman.
Isn't that, why wouldn't that explanation go for the Metro Transit tax, too? Because that's being imposed by the counties also. I think it's exactly the same. So I think you lost some of us on that logic there.
Well, Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I think one of the things I said was that economic times have changed as well. And we deal with the circumstances that are in front of us right now, and they're very different economically than they were even a year ago, a year and a half ago. So okay. I think it's one of the things that served the governor well. He's willing to reconsider a position, and I think at this point, tax increases, even authorization for tax increases that may have been palatable a year, 2 years, I think we need to say that they need to take a time out and a breather for our tax increases at a time when we have economic troubles on the horizon.
Then one, Mr. Chairman. So apparently it wasn't necessary to offset the governor's cigarette tax increase because the economic times were different. Is that the rationale there? Because when the governor imposed that cigarette tax, there was no offset.
Oh. Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, no, there was no offset, and also there were dire budget issues that had to be addressed. And I think the governor did his best to find the lever that was most palatable to pull in order to reach a compromise on the budget. The offset just wasn't part of the equation when we had $4.5 billion budget deficit, the largest budget deficit in the country per capita. So I think that is. I mean, I think there's the extenuating circumstances call for, you know, extenuating actions.
Senator Pogemiller.
Apparently we're the eighth largest deficit right now, I think the figure is. Is that what you understand it to be per capita?
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I don't know. I'd have to ask that question of Commissioner Hansen. I'm not aware of that.
Could you ask him? Because that's
sure
our understanding that I think, isn't that what we were told? Eighth largest per capita deficit? So you don't think this deficit is as severe or is going to be as severe as the previous one, and therefore giving up revenue is probably okay?
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, all I can say is based on what I know today, it's not nearly as large. I mean, it's a little over 3% of our general fund budget. That other one was 15% of our general fund budget.
Are you pretty confident by the summer or fall that revenue won't be necessary? that you're that you're suggesting, that the governor's suggesting giving up on the sales tax? You're saying that revenue probably won't be necessary by the summer or fall?
Commissioner?
Chairman, I'm Senator Paul Bloomer. I make no predictions. I'm not a forecaster. I'm a tax administrator. I just collect the taxes, so I'm not a forecaster. You'd have to ask Dr. Stinson or Commissioner Hansen. That is outside my purview and my expertise.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't see any mention of the reduction in the motor vehicle sales tax, which will occur because an exception isn't carved out. Motor vehicle sales tax simply keys off the sales tax rate. Maybe I'm not seeing it, but I think there is a cut to the motor vehicle sales tax.
Commissioner?
Chairman, Senator Dibble, yeah, we have, you're right, we've corrected the language. The motor vehicle sales tax remains at 6.5%. So that's...
Oh, was that a change that was brought forward?
Yeah, it's in the bill language. I can find it for you.
I believe
you.
I saw that in the summary.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. If you have the bill in front of you, it's section 41 or 44, and it does clarify that the sales tax for motor vehicles remains at 6.5%.
Mr. Chair.
Chair Ortman.
About the sales tax, it seems to me appropriate to look at the overall base statewide. We have local communities raising in their areas, and what the governor's offered now is a reduction in the overall base. I think that's appropriate. But I had a question for the commissioner about how much we raise every year and have over the last several years, to just talk about how much that burden is increasing. I think it's at $17 billion, but I'm wondering what that's been like from 2003 up through 2008.
Well, you got me a Chairman, Senator Ortman. Boy, I don't have that off the top of my head. I do.
Can
not
you provide
know.
That to
I
the
could.
Committee? I think that'd be very interesting
that.
To see how much that we have increased in our revenues as a result of increases in the sales tax, and also to see what the impact will be of the changes that we've made to date so far this year.
And what year is it, 2003 on?
Yeah.
Senator Larson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Innes, it just seems strange to me that going back to the sales tax, that to mitigate the impacts of essentially the transportation bill, you provide a reduction in the rate across the state when the increases in the counties that choose to participate in funding transit. Why wouldn't the logic be that if the governor wanted to provide general fund relief for communities that are making that choice to deal with their infrastructure problems, why wouldn't that relief go to those places if truly it's meant to mitigate?
Chairman, Senator Larson, to say it was just this reduction was not solely meant to mitigate just the sales tax impacts of that transportation bill, but the entire impacts of the transportation bill. I mean, the gas tax is one of the most regressive taxes we have. And so it was more looking at it in a macro way. We spent a lot of time in this committee last year and in the House Tax Committee talking about the slightly trending regressivity of our state tax revenue system, state and local tax and revenue system. The bill that passed earlier this session exacerbates that trend line. There's no question about it. And so this slight tax reduction was not just to offset the regressivity of the sales tax that may or may not be imposed, but also to offset the gas tax and the other revenue sources that were in that bill. So it was looked at a more macro perspective than that.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Pogemiller.
From a macro perspective, how would one fix the slight regressivity of the tax system? Have there been proposals on the table in the last few years that would have improved on that, and have they been accepted by the executive branch?
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I would say the most ambitious proposal that have been talked about has been the area of property taxes, doing more on the PTR, doing some more LGA, do some of those type of things, and there has been discussions. We've put forth our ideas about that. But it's one thing to say the status quo, and it's, you know, you compare us relative to other revenue systems, we are one of the most proportional and least regressive tax systems in the country. Now, that may not be good enough. Maybe we should work to make it more proportional. But passing legislation that is that is full of exclusively regressive taxes isn't probably the right way to go either to alter that distribution. And that's what this legislature did this year.
Well,
Senator Pogomar.
Just, Commissioner, I think if you want to go down that path, then I think we're going to have to ramp up the discussion of fiscal responsibility. Because I think there's some question how fiscally responsible it is to use the budget reserve and to cut revenue at a time when we're there's some of us that are really a bit puzzled by, I mean, the one thing you'd expect out of a conservative governor would be fiscal responsibility, and I really think, I mean, we're having an internal discussion as whether we should protect the governor from himself here or not, because we know what happened in the late 70s, early 80s, and I just don't think it'd be fiscally responsible to go with the governor's tendencies right now. I think that would hurt the state. So I think we're a little stunned at the lack of fiscal responsibility coming in his proposal.
Commissioner, I have a question on the FOC language. Kind of to Senator Pogomiller's point, the Senate has long held that there should be a 90% subtraction for the foreign royalties, and then last year in the bill we had 80. So, I mean, there's not a big revenue difference, but I mean, what is there a group of businesses that benefit from a 80% subtraction that are affected differently with a 90% subtraction?
Chairman, I'm questioning my own recollection on the veto tax bill. My recollection was that both the single sales phase-in was part of that compromise, and also the increase from the royalty subtraction to 80 to 90% was in the bill that got to the governor's desk. In this proposal, we have not included the sales tax, the acceleration of the single sales, but we did include going from 80 to 90% on the royalty subtraction. And you're right, Chairman, there is a subgroup of businesses that do benefit from that, use that, highly utilize that royalty subtraction. And they are they're the medical device companies in the state, the Medtronic, the St. Jude's, and they're going to get pinched a little bit on their other FOC changes. For the most part, they're using it very legitimately in the way it was intended, but they are going to be pinched a little bit on it. So in recognition of that, and they're such important global competitors for us, we thought increasing the royalty subtraction from 80 to 90% made sense. And you're right, Chairman, I think it only is about a $5 to $6 million revenue impact. So we thought it was doable.
$5 or $6 million could make a difference this year.
I think it's actually about $7 million. But anything else, members, from the commissioner? Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. We look forward to you adopting it in its entirety.
Commissioner, if we were going to cut taxes, I mean, wouldn't the single sales factor have been a smarter thing for us to do than an eighth of a percent? I mean, if we're really concerned about the economy, wouldn't accelerating single sales a little more aggressively have been a better initiative for the governor than a sales tax reduction?
Well, Chairman, as you know, I'm preaching to the choir here. I've been a big advocate of single sales for 10 years, I think, I've been working on that issue. You know, I think with the economic times we're facing right now, he wanted a more broad-based tax reduction, you know, something that would go to, you know, pretty much everybody rather than just shaving a year or two off the single sales. You know, we're scheduled to get there in 2014. So the best we could probably have done is shave it down to 2011 or something. And with the economic times we have right now, that's not going to do any good in the short term. So in one respect, it's a very, I think, strategic way. I mean, the single sales is a long-term, makes a lot of sense strategically. But I think she was looking for something more short-term to help in these, you know, these extenuating circumstances. And that the best we could have done is shaved off a year or two. And that,
Commissioner, I think with $77 million, you could have took more than a year or two off. I think last year the cost of it was 20-some million, and I think we took 2 years off. So it's significantly more than that. Senator Scoy?
Well, Mr. Chair,
Commissioner Itis, you know, speaking of the short-term stimulus package, has the department estimated what this 8% sales tax reduction does for a family of four with kind of an average state income? I mean, how much money is it for that family?
Chairman, Senator Scully, you know, I think Paul Wilson has done kind of a typical household, what the impact would be. My recollection on the income tax credit is that was about, I think it was 1250 of an individual and 25 a household. I think this is about twice that over the course of a year.
So,
granted, so on a $20 purchase, it's 2.5 cents. That's you kind of look at it like that. But I also think it sends a message that, you know what, we're not going to be increasing taxes any longer. We're going to, somewhat of a tax decrease.
About 25 bucks for an individual or $50 for a family.
Something like that. I can confirm those numbers, but I think that's in the ballpark, Senator.
Senator Pokemon.
Commissioner, though, I'm having a kind of an inconsistency thing going on here. You got the cigarette tax increase from a couple of years ago. You got this corporate tax increase. How are you sending the signal that Tim Pawlenty's not going to raise taxes? Because he keeps raising taxes, but talking like he's not raising taxes. And it just seems inconsistent to me.
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, I think this governor has been willing to look at the tax code, and he's looked at this FOC for a number of years now.
He understands
that there is an issue, an issue of compliance, maybe compliance is probably the wrong word, but whether this provision is really doing what it was intended to do. And revisiting that and shoring that up and reestablishing the original intent of that provision, I mean, you can call it a tax increase, but I think it's bringing integrity back to that provision, reestablishing the integrity that originally was there. And I think that's, you can call that a tax increase, you can call it a revenue raiser, a revenue enhancement, whatever you want to call it, but it's the right thing to do by the tax code, it's the right thing to do by the taxpayers, and it's good tax policy.
But Mr. Chairman,
Senator Pokemon.
Commissioner, when the Senate Tax Committee suggested it over the last 5 or 6 years, it was a tax increase. When Governor Plenty suggests it, it's now fixing the system. I think maybe the governor was wrong in the last few years on that. I think I agree with the explanation you're giving now. And then the hospital tax increase in the health care proposal, does this sales tax reduction again, does that offset tax increase in the health care bill that the governor is supporting and recommending? That's in the Berglund, Huntley, Pawlenty bill that raises taxes on hospitals, I believe.
Chairman,
does this sales tax offset that also, that tax increase of the governor?
Chairman, Senator Pogemiller, that's outside my purview. I've never made that linkage. I don't know if the administration has.
So it only offsets the tax increases that bipartisan group of the legislature supported on transportation. It doesn't offset any of the governor's tax increases. I mean, I can live with that. Just trying to get the rationale straight.
Commissioner, thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Committee.
Senator Armand, I think we have some people who would like to testify on the bill. Nan Madden, Minnesota Budget Project.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nan Madden. I am director of the Minnesota Budget Project, which is an initiative of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. We provide independent research, analysis, and advocacy on budget and tax issues with particular attention to the impact that fiscal decisions have on low and moderate income Minnesotans. I'd like to testify today in strong opposition to the deep cuts to the renter's credit included in the governor's budget proposal. This proposal is unfair and would increase the regressivity of our tax system. The renter's credit provides a reduction in property taxes for over 271,000 low and moderate income Minnesota households whose rents are high in relation to their income. Seniors and persons with severe disabilities make up 29% of all renter's credit recipients. In 13 counties in greater Minnesota, at least one half of the households receiving the renter's credit include seniors or persons with disabilities. The governor's proposal would cut the renter's credit over 20%. That's an average loss of credit of $119 a year, or $68 million total in the next biennium. I think in looking at the renter's credit, the crucial question is whether it is doing what it's meant to be doing, which is reducing the regressivity of the state's property tax system. Rental property taxes are among the most regressive taxes in the state. Even after the renter's credit offsets a portion of these property taxes, the rental property taxes remain more regressive than nearly all other tax types, and that would get worse under the governor's proposal. We think the discussion about the percentage of rent that constitute property taxes kind of loses track of the big picture, which is what's the overall impact of the renter's credit in reducing regressivity of the tax system. It's not clear to us that the figures that revenue have come up with as that percentage hold true today and in 2008, as well as they did in 2004 due to changes in the market. We think it's also important to recognize from our understanding and discussions with legislators who participated at the time when we did go to a straight percentage of rent constituting property taxes, that that was done at a time to protect renters in conjunction with a tax reduction on rental property taxes. And there was a concern at that time, and I think that concern remains today, about whether the savings that property owners receive in their property taxes actually gets passed on to renters. I would add that that percentage of rent that's considered property taxes is just one part of the calculation of the renter's credit. And I think if we're concerned about just that piece, we could work on developing a revenue neutral proposal that changes other factors in that formula so that we're still having the same ultimate impact of reducing regressivity in rental property taxes, which again is one of the most regressive taxes we have in the state. In addition, we're concerned with the degree to which the governor's budget relies on low-income people, people with disabilities, the elderly, and other vulnerable populations to play a disproportionate role in helping solve the state's budget deficit. When the governor brought forward a similar proposal to cut the renter's credit in 2005, a coalition of over 160 organizations from across the state representing various communities, including low-income families, seniors, persons with disabilities, victims of domestic violence, and others, united in opposition to these cuts in the renter's credit. The Senate strongly rejected the governor's proposal to cut the renter's credit in 2005, and we'd urge you to do so again this year. And I did bring a fact sheet for the members of the importance of renter's credit in the different counties in the state. I also have with me Jessica Webster to testify on the same issue.
Ms. Webster, please state your name for the record.
Jessica Webster with Legal Aid. Mr. Chair, members, just briefly, we have Legal Aid has three concerns about cutting the renter's credit. Members, this is not the year to cut the renter's credit. All of you have been working diligently on the mortgage foreclosure crisis, and renters across the state are really the innocent victims of the mortgage foreclosure crisis. We've got families who have lost their homes, are losing their homes, their rental homes. They've lost their security deposits. They have to come up with first month's rent. They're moving into a new apartment, and then we're going to cut the renter's credit and essentially kick these families when they're down. It's really distressing to us that this proposal would be considered particularly right now during the mortgage foreclosure crisis. Second, with our weakening economy and our rising unemployment and rising costs across the board, this does represent a significant hardship for these families, this cut. And finally, as Nan said, we find it profoundly unfair to turn to the families that can least afford this to help balance the budget. So we hope that the committee will be really thoughtful about this proposal, particularly right now in this climate. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webster. Next, we'll have ask Steve Johnson, Minnesota Bankers Association, Robin Rowan from the Insurance and Financial Services Council, Mara Humphrey and David Skillbred to come forward as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. If you'll allow, pinch hit for Steve Johnson, if that's okay, on behalf of the Minnesota Bankers Association. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Hill Girard Associates. Again, representing the Minnesota Bankers Association. And I just want to comment briefly on their behalf with respect to the financial institution data match proposal that is in this bill. We have had an opportunity to visit a little bit with the department. They understand some of our concerns, and just very briefly with the department. And so I'll just walk through some of the concerns, and I know some of the others who are impacted have issues as well. And I also want to say that, I mean, from a banker's perspective, obviously it's our objective, and we hope that the Department of Revenue will collect all the taxes owed to them. But the issue is really that this is modeled after the child support data match program, and I think there are some very keen distinctions and differences between that. That is a federal program. It is federally mandated. All the states have to do it, but also there is a federal system process that can be used. So if you're a financial institution that operates in more than one state, you use the federal system as opposed to on a state-by-state basis. What that also means is that an individual cannot move their funds in order to hide, move their assets in order to hide from the child support collection process, because it applies in every state. As a state-specific data match program, someone could move their assets to another state or to an internet account and avoid having the lien on their account. There are a couple due process issues, I think, that we still want to discuss further with the department. I know Indiana has instituted a data match last year, but I don't believe it's fully implemented, and I know they're working through some of the due process issues as well. There's some jurisdictional questions with respect to individuals who might have accounts in Minnesota financial institutions but reside elsewhere. From a cost perspective to financial institutions, there are more costs associated with state-specific programs. Even if the department does some sort of web-based system, there are still internal costs to the financial institutions. And I know that some of the other states provide more in terms of reimbursement to the financial institutions in order to cover their costs associated with the program. I know there are potentially some liability concerns, some data privacy concerns that we are discussing with the department. And we do have some concerns, as I mentioned earlier, that there will be diminishing returns to the state because the individuals with tax liens could move their funds and avoid having them attached by the Department of Revenue, because they could move them out of state or to internet. And thereby the financial institutions will have gone through a lot of work, and yet the state may not realize what they're hoping to realize. I think with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Humphrey.
Ms. Humphrey, please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Mara Humphrey, I'm the Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Minnesota Credit Union Network. We represent the state's 162 credit unions. And I'm here to testify in opposition to the Department of Revenue's data match proposal. I'll second some of Judy's comments. We're concerned about the additional burden that this is going to place on credit unions. And specifically, one of our concerns is the ability of credit unions to comply with this proposal and their ability to comply with the technical aspects of this, especially some of our smaller credit unions. Under the Child Support Data Match program, which is very similar to this, credit unions and financial institutions are able to provide the data through both electronic media or by mailing, delivering, or faxing the info. And this proposal requires financial institutions to transmit it in encrypted form by secure electronic means. We have been working with the department on this, and I appreciate their willingness to work with us on the technical side, but we do have some concerns about the ability of some of the smaller institutions to be able to implement this. We also have some broader privacy concerns regarding the liability that this would place on credit unions and financial institutions by sharing this information, and also some privacy concerns that this would raise. We also echo the concerns of the cost that this would be to financial institutions. They will need to have the ability to comply and run these matches. And from my understanding, there could be expensive startup costs because this is only in Minnesota. So credit unions will have to work with their data processors to develop a specific program for Minnesota to be able to run these matches. One of my mid-sized credit unions estimated that the cost that their data processor would charge us to set this up would be $5,000, and the proposed $150 in the bill comes nowhere close to making up for that. So just wanted to share some of our concerns about the additional burden that this would place on credit unions. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Skillbred, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Skillbred, Vice President of Government Relations for the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota. Also testifying on Sections 1 and Sections 8 regarding the bank data match, I'm not going to repeat what the two previous people said, but those concerns are ours also. I'll just add a couple of things, however. On the cost and on the logistics side, depending on the size of the institution and the bank, those will be difficult to implement on the to do this matching system. It's modeled after a child support system done by DHS, but that system is different in one important aspect. That system allows banks to either upload their customer base, in which the department scrubs it internally, looks for the matches, or banks may download DHS's banks' names and then scrub those internally. That is a very different system from this one. This one will require the scrubbing to be done in the bank by the financial institution, and therefore they will have to implement all of the software and technology components necessary to be able to do that. Secondly, with respect to some other states, some other states have done this, but there are two interesting facts about that. Number one, because it would be state-specific, the people that we would need to hire to provide this technology, they're going to take a little bit more time to get this done. So implementing a program by July 1 would be very, very aggressive, considering there are some 400 institutions in Minnesota that would have to do this, and the services... The servicers will be a little bit less likely and slower to respond because it is state-specific. Secondly, the Indiana program, which was referenced once before, that program, like DHS's program, allows the bank to either upload the file or download the file, and the scrubbing to occur at either the department or on the bank end. So we've got a lot of concerns about this. We've met with revenue staff. We'll continue to do so, and thank you for your time.
Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Robin Rowan. I'm the executive director of the New Life Insurance Trade, the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council. We represent over 90% of the insurance, life insurance written in Minnesota, and about 18,000 jobs. I'm here also to express our concerns over the financial institution data match program. We have the same administrative concerns as the banks, so I won't reiterate those, but we do have some additional concerns based on the very different nature of the products that we sell. This program is different from the child support data match program in that the definition of account is much broader. And for life insurance companies, it simply refers to any funds or property held by the life insurance company. We offer a variety of products, so it could refer to anything from disability to long-term care benefit payments, policy values, or death benefits payable from a life insurance policy or an annuity. And what's also different about our products vis-a-vis the banks is that our products are generally for the benefit of someone else, not the insured or the debtor. It's generally dependents or some other person. So if the value is taken out of the policy or the proceeds are diminished, there are other people that will suffer the consequences, not just the debtor or the insured. We are also talking to the department, and we will continue to talk with them. But as it's written now, we are very concerned about the proposal. We also have questions about how much revenue there actually is that can be gained from the life insurance side of things, especially since it's not money sitting there as it is in a bank account. It's generally something has to happen before that money is available. Either somebody has to die or they have to exercise their contract rights to surrender the policy. So it's not just money that's sitting there. It requires another act. So we're not sure, given all the administrative concerns we have, how much is to be gained on the revenue side. And as I said, we're talking to the department. We'll continue to talk to them. But as it stands now, we have some significant concerns. Thank you.
Ms. Rowden, I think, and I'm sorry I wasn't here, but I believe this provision, if it's going to be carried, will be carried in the finance bill. So somebody should probably be in contact with Senator Cohen about that.
Thank you. We will do that.
Thank you. Senator Fogelman?
So the industry thinks that it's not going to generate $10 million
here.
I don't know how much. I can't speak to that specifically. We don't know how much of that is from banks versus from life insurance companies.
Okay.
We just question on the life insurance side how much of that is available.
And has
Senator Pogman.
And has the department broken that out? Have they made an estimate of that? Do you know? Or
I don't know. They were going to look into that.
Okay. So to be determined.
To be continued.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nauman, Gary Carlson, you want to come up at the same time? And, yeah. Joe Matthews, you want to join us at the same time? I'll bet you feel the same way they do.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'd like to focus on two sections of the bill, or actually two areas of the bill. First, on the Section 49 utility host transition aid payment. That is, we have a problem with the way that's structured. It's only a temporary offset to the tax base loss that would occur to the utility host cities. Our League of Cities policies, endorsed by all of our members, support a permanent total fix to the loss of tax base for those utility host cities. This, again, is only a temporary fix for that program. I think Mr. Peterson will be speaking on that in just a minute. But the bigger concern, I think, or the biggest concern for us is the imposition of levy limits under Sections 9 through 14. We strongly oppose levy limits. We've brought that message to this committee, I think, almost every year as it's been discussed. Let me give you a little rationale for our opposition. First of all, these specific levy limits are only based on levy, not levy plus aid. So what that will do is for a city that receives about 50 cents on its dollar from LGA, it will only have an inflationary plus household growth adjustment based upon its levy. So a city that's more heavily dependent on LGA, which would tend to be a city with a weaker tax base, would have less levy authority under these levy limits. These levy limits also do not include any adjustment factor for commercial industrial tax base growth. In the past, we've had kind of a historical standard of also adjusting not only for households but also for CI growth for those communities that are not adding houses but are adding tax base that needs service that is classified as CI. The governor's levy limits do not anticipate fluctuations in LGA. So a city could lose LGA and actually receive less of a levy increase because of that loss of LGA. They would actually have to absorb that within their budget. And then finally, two quick things that I would encourage you to think about. Number one is I will hear from every frugal city out there that says, you know what, we held our levy down and now we're being penalized because we did that. And the other part of that argument is that Commissioner Ines said we would probably have almost a 2% reduction in the tax increase. I would encourage you to think very carefully about that comment, because I will tell you that cities will look at the levy limits, and I think counties would probably do the same thing and say, well, if we don't levy this year, we're going to lose authority for next year, because these are permanent levy limits. And I would argue that those cities that maybe held their levies very low may be encouraged, because of the guessing game over levy limits, to actually raise their levy to the limit rather than hold their levy down below the limit. So I would encourage you to think very carefully about the stimulative effect that can actually occur. Levy limits can actually be a floor rather than a ceiling in many instances, because cities need to preserve that authority for maybe future projects that may be before them. Mr. Chair, I'll turn it over to Ms. Nauman.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Carlson. I would encourage you to go back with regard to the levy limits and the amount of levy increases. Representative Marquardt had some data, and I don't have it in front of me, but I think he went back to about 1970 when he had the levy increases across the state, and he looked at the years that we had levy limits in place and the ones that we did not. and kind of averaged it all out. And actually, they're about the same, whether you have levy limits in place or not. If you take out the 2 years that we had the big property tax changes, I think it was 71 and 90 or 2001. Actually, the years that we had levy limits in place, the levies increased more than they did the years we did not. And so, you know, maybe we could take a little look at that, and if you've got some information, forward that on to me.
Mr. Chair and Senator Skoy, I think that is probably the effect I was referring to, that our cities and counties do look at those levy limits and they think about their future next 2 or 3 years' budgets, and they realize that if they don't levy, they will then be penalized rather than setting their levy as they really locally need it. So there is a guessing game that does go on, I have to admit, with the levy limits.
Thank you.
Ms. Dahlman?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the opportunity to address the committee today. My name is Patricia Nauman, and I represent Metro Cities. We have 86 member cities in the 7-county metro area, including the core cities, fully developed cities, developing cities, and cities on the urban fringe. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on Senate File 3665. We know that the legislature and the governor have a difficult task ahead in trying to balance the state's budget deficit, that this will not be an easy task. We appreciate that the governor did not include cuts to local government aid or the market value homestead credit in this proposal. However, we would respectfully oppose the governor's proposal to impose levy limits on cities. Local control is a fundamental principle for our member cities. Our cities vary significantly in size, location, and stage of development, but they all agree that cities are in the best position to make the decisions about the appropriate level of taxation for their communities. Levy limits only serve to make the local budgeting process less accountable. Local elected officials are accountable to the citizens they represent. We also believe that the way the governor's proposal is structured, that is by imposing the levy limit on just levy and not levy plus aid, does hurt property poor cities. Property taxes are the main vehicle in which cities finance basic services like sanitary sewer, clean water, safe streets, and police and fire protection. These are services that provide the basis of a city's economic prosperity and the services on which we all depend to run our daily lives. Cities provide these services reliably and efficiently. Government revenues across all sectors have been declining for the last several years, and city revenues have declined at a rate even more significantly than state revenues. So that means that cities are already working to provide these services at reduced cost. So again, we would oppose the levy limits that are contained in this bill. Thank you.
Mr. Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. And I'll echo a lot of the comments that were already made by the cities, but I did want to point out a few ways in which counties are different. Even though our county program aid was not cut in the governor's budget, we are going to see a number of hits in other areas of the budget, including short-term offenders, targeted case management, et cetera. And I just think it's important for the committee to realize that if you adjust county revenues for inflation, total county revenues, in 2005 we were at the same point we were at in 1999. There really hasn't been a lot of actual growth. Since 2003 to 2008, if you adjust for both growth and inflation, county revenues are actually down 12.6%. So I think it's important to understand that our folks are doing everything they can do to keep property taxes down, but there's been a lot of challenges that we've faced. And the message we brought to the legislature is don't impose levy limits. Instead, work with us to help address our major cost drivers. And the governor's budget really isn't doing that. I think the legislature made a prudent move in taking the first step in the transportation bill. That was a huge issue for all counties, all 87 counties, and we'd like to applaud you for that. I think there are other areas where we've made positive moves forward, but this year, with a deficit, we expect we'll likely step backward a little bit. Also, again, I just want to echo the comments that were made by the cities that our folks are up for election, and it's frustrating on a number of fronts, I think, when they feel that for some reason their election certificate doesn't give them the same ability to represent the folks that elected them than the folks here in St. Paul. And so I think with that, I'll end my comments. I think, again, I just want to echo what the cities have already mentioned. I think Keith might have some additional comments.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout that identifies explicitly the adjustments occurring in programs uniquely affecting counties within the budget, and just want to make it clear to the committee that we are the one level of local government that is actually suffering cuts for all of our members in the governor's budget. I won't go into detail. of those because of the time considerations for the committee, but they will affect our levies and or the services that we provide, and would like the committee to be cognizant of what's occurring in the other committees as they make the decisions that affect us. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll end my comments and be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee? Would anybody else like to testify on Mr. Cox? On the governor's budget proposal.
Morning, Mr. Chair. I'm Wayne Cox, Executive Director of Minnesota Citizens for Tax Justice. We're a tax and budget research group whose members include the Minnesota AFL-CIO and a number of other civic and labor organizations. Let me just raise a couple of points in the bill that we'd like you to consider. First, in terms of the overall thrust of the bill, Minnesota faces a significant deficit this year in this biennium and a more significant deficit next biennium. This is the governor's revenue proposal that has a major part in dealing with that. But we find that if you apply his solutions to the problem, we'll still end up with a $1.7 billion deficit in the upcoming biennium when you factor in the real cost of government services by applying an inflation factor that's in the finance report. So this particular revenue proposal doesn't work. We'll still be in a big, big hole because we've not addressed the significant revenue problem we face in the state. So we would encourage the committee to take a look at the real problem, which is the revenue shortfall, and attempt to apply a solution that will give us greater deficit protection this year and into the future. Secondly, some of the particular items in the governor's bill, we agree with the cities and counties that there's no need for levy limits. Levy limits is a solution in search of a problem. Minnesota's cities and counties over the last five years, when you factor in inflation, they're spending between 12 and 13% less per capita than they did 5 years ago. Minnesota cities and counties are not spending to the stars, quite the opposite. They have, because of the reductions in local government aid, they have had to severely cut back on the services they provide. That's had an impact on services. It's had an impact on the economy by elimination of jobs and taking paychecks off of Main Street. So we would encourage you not to support the governor's proposal in that area. With respect to the renter's credit, we think is an important part of the mix of taxes and credits that help reduce the overall regressivity of the overall tax system. If you take away the amount of renter's credit they're talking about, it would have a significant reduction in the overall progressivity versus regressivity of the tax system. It would make the overall system more regressive. The governor is proposing to reduce the state sales tax by 1/8 of 1%. We have a significant revenue problem. I don't understand how you get out of a significant revenue problem by reducing revenues. It would help slightly in terms of reducing the regressivity of the overall system. But you got a bigger problem on your hands that you need to deal with, and that's getting your revenue system back to the point where we can maintain Minnesota's essential services, and you got a long way to go to get there. So in terms of the overall approach, we don't think it's a blueprint that you ought to be following. In terms of a couple of the specifics, we think that you ought to reject his counsel. We do find one positive element in there, and that is that the governor is now joining with the legislature in the effort to close the loop, the tax avoidance loophole that's in the foreign operating corporations area. So that is certainly meritorious, and we urge you to act on that.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Members, any questions? Mr. Chair. Senator Sundrum.
Thank you. And was it Mr. Cox?
Yes.
Mr. Cox, you've offered a fair amount of thoughts, as well as others have done as well, as about what not to do. What would be your recommendation to do? I mean, we've got the deficit. We've got people out there that are, in many cases, hurting substantially with bills, with payments, with foreclosures, and it's not an easy time. Do you have any thoughts about what we ought to be doing?
Well, there is one particular revenue raiser that you ought to be considering. It's one that the legislature has adopted in various forms in recent years. It has been vetoed by the governor in past years. That would be to return to a higher top rate on the individual income tax for the highest earners in the state. That particular form of tax increase would not have any effect by definition of who it applies to those people who are hurting in the state. What it would do would be to take away what now amounts to about a $5,000 a year, every year, tax cut that people in the highest incomes enjoy and have enjoyed each year for the last 8 or 9 years since those tax cuts were put into play. You can do it and raise about, if you raise it up to 9%, you would gain about $400 million a year in revenue. If you did a slightly less, you'd get slightly less revenue. But certainly that ought to be the linchpin of restoring revenues in the state so that we don't continue to compromise services and we don't continue to cut jobs of public servants that helps that hurts the economy by taking paychecks off of Main Street. So we would think that would be the principal way you ought to go about doing it. We don't think it would have any significant negative effect on the economy, because what it would do would be to provide the revenues that would prevent you from having to take more paychecks off of Main Street. It would prevent you from having to cut essential services that provide dollars that stay in the state. The actual source of the money would probably not even be money that is currently residing in Minnesota in many cases. It would probably, individuals would probably have to take, that $5,000 out of their Fidelity account in Boston or out of their Citibank account or wherever else they're holding their money. So we think that would be economically a better solution and would help you get a handle on your deficit problem.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Thank you.
Senator, anything else, members? Would anybody else like to testify on the governor's tax proposal?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bradley Peterson, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities, and would like to comment very quickly on the governor's proposal for utility transition aid. We continue to believe that the class rate change that has been proposed in the past is the best way to go on this. The governor's transition aid is very temporary in scope. It's only 2 years, whereas this creates a tax shift of $34 million every year. The governor's proposal is also very limited in scope in that it only picks up a few cities and townships that are affected by this. The class rate change solves the problem for everyone. And finally, the governor's proposal solves this problem by spending money, whereas the class rate change doesn't require you to spend any money. And so we continue to believe that it is the superior way to solve this problem and hope that the legislature will continue to consider some solution that is based on the class rate change versus the short-term, limited, and inadequate transition aid that the governor proposes.
Mr. Peterson, thank you. Would anybody else like to testify on the bill? Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't recall, but maybe possibly, was there a revenue amount attached to the data match?
It's about $10 million.
$10 million.
But it would, I think, I don't know if you were here, Senator Johnson, I indicated that if that provision is going to be carried, it'll be carried in the finance bill, not in the tax bill.
I heard that, Mr. Chairman, but I'm just wondering about the implementation of this is going to be really onerous on these businesses, and I'm just wondering if $10 million is, regardless of where that shows up.
Well, I think, Senator Johnson, there is a question about whether the reimbursement back to the financial institutions is adequate. And I think I'm going to indicate that to Senator Cohen. I've had some discussions with the banking community, and some more work might need to be done in that area to make sure that it doesn't become a burden on them to match the data. Anything else? Senator Ortman, anything further?
Thank you, members. I would move that we lay this bill on the table.
Senator Ortman moves that Senate file 3665 be laid on the table for possible inclusion in the committee's omnibus bill. And I think there probably are some provisions in here we're probably going to pick up, Senator Ortman. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Senator Rest. Senator Rests, which bill would you like to start with?
I'll start with one for which I have a witness. So Senate file 3709. Mr. Chairman, I think it was 1995, we had a proposal that for the city of Crystal, and I think there were a couple of other cities too, Fridley maybe, and a couple of others, that established a scattered site tax increment districts to be able, the purpose of which was to be able to put in areas where there was substandard housing, single-family homes, to allow market-rate housing to be built on those sites after the substandard homes, or maybe even sometimes a vacant lot. But when the homes were demolished. Crystal's needs since that time, in the last 13 years, have now changed for, and instead of needing the so-called market rate housing, they now need to be able to have the flexibility to use the increments from those scattered site districts for affordable housing. And what Senate file 3709 does is to permit the increments from those districts to go into a housing account to be able to give loans, to be able to use those dollars for housing purposes across the city. So it is an opportunity for the city of Crystal to be more flexible in the dollars that are coming from those tax increment districts. Mr. Mark Hoffman, who is a Crystal City Council member, is here to answer questions about how the funds have been used and whatever you'd like to know in detail about the proposal, but the basic thing is to be able to establish a housing development account with the TIF dollars and to give the city more flexibility in their use of them throughout the city.
Senator Dibble had a proposal similar to this, except if I remember it correctly, the intent was to use it on, was it vacant and boarded up properties? So, I mean, it kind of narrowed the use of what the increment would be used for.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Crystal doesn't suffer from, at least not yet, to any great extent to the boarded up properties that the city of Minneapolis does. And when we did this in 1995, we did include the city of Minneapolis, quite frankly, was another one that we included in the scattered site housing tax increment financing proposals. And I get maybe council can say what other cities were involved in that.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members, the cities that were in the 1995 law were Crystal, Fridley, Minneapolis, and St. Paul.
Oh, not too bad a memory there. Got them all but one. The one of the things that I thought was a very responsible part of that proposal was that often when people are doing the tax increment districts, they want the whole value written down to zero. In order to capture every single cent to the TIF district. But the proposals that we had then did not provide for that, and the land value was the starting value, and whatever value was added by the structures that were put on the land, that's what was captured, rather than writing the land value down to zero as well.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Rest. This just changes the use of the funds. This doesn't extend the TIF. Is that correct?
I don't believe so.
That's correct.
Yeah, I think it was a 15-year district. I mean, these are housing replacement districts, and I just like for the city of Minneapolis, I'm not familiar exactly with Senator Dibble's bill, but specific use there. Here it is for meeting the affordable housing needs because the market value needs are no longer as compelling for our particular city.
Your witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is Mark Hoffman. I'm the president of the Crystal Economic Development Authority, and I also sit on the Crystal City Council. Just a little background on Crystal. We are a inner ring suburb. We have about a population of 23,000. 80% of our housing stock is single family, and the preponderance of our stock was built, you know, post-World War II, mostly between about 1946 and 1970. So we're getting to that age where we need a little bit of help. Things that we currently do, our housing stock, like I said, is moderate right now. We are in the opening price points for first-time home buyers, and that's probably where we'll stay. We don't anticipate seeing our stock changing that much. Currently, we do work with the Northwest Housing Resource Center for technical and financial assistance. The EDA funds incentive rebate programs for home improvements. We do use CDBG funds for deferred home improvement loans. We pursue development through wherever we can use the money from Crystal. And most importantly, one of our main things today is through our regulatory tools that we enforce property maintenance issues to try to stay ahead of the game. That's our system today. What we're looking at this legislation doing really is to fund using the available tax increment dollars to fill the unmet needs of the city in handling the housing programs. The big change is we're going to look for financial incentives that encourage single-family transformation projects. This could be remodeling, expansions, reconstruction, to upgrade the stock of the homes that are predominantly, like I said, the post-World War II. We're looking to provide funds for the purchase of distressed family, single-family properties from voluntary sellers, subsequently selling them to partner housing agencies for rehab and resale. We're also looking for financial incentives to rehab or major capital improvements to our large multifamily apartment buildings, and to allocate funds for the acquisition of distressed smaller multifamily properties for demolition and redevelopment. This special legislation would enable the city to rely upon the use of available increments from the existing TIF district to provide additional funding for those housing activities to focus primarily on the preservation of our existing homes. Just a few things to go through on the bill. What this would allow is the Crystal Economic Development, upon the creation of the Housing Development Account, to deposit in that account the tax increment revenues defined from the two existing home replacement districts. The funding in the home development account would be used for housing activities listed in the bill. We would be maintaining and reporting requirements of the Minnesota statutes relating to the amount of tax increment received and expended. The bill does not, as you asked earlier, does not extend the duration of the original districts. The bill does not modify the original purpose of the districts. It merely allows us to use the tax increment funds derived from the housing development replacement district to be deposited in a new housing development account. And the new one also, this would also help us to go from parcel-based market value housing to maintaining and preserving our current funding. If this passes, what we're looking at is really this summer we could start with redevelopment projects, construction projects in the city, which would, with our size, help us tremendously at the property tax base. So thank you very much for your time. I could answer any questions if you have them. Try to answer them.
Mr. Hoffman, how much increment do districts 1 and 2 generate now?
Right now, we're sitting on a tally of about $220,000. Over the next 5 years of the life of the district, we'd probably collect another $250,000. So we're about $475,000, $480,000. For us, that's a pretty substantial amount of money to go out and do a lot of projects with. So we're looking under $500,000 through the course of the project, the life of the districts.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, there's one element in the bill that I do want to draw people's attention to, and I don't mean this to be finding a flaw in my own bill, but I do think that the committee needs to pay attention to it, and that is in section subdivision 4, where the funds that would be loaned out would be increment funds, but as they would be collected, they would not be considered increment in terms of their use. And I think that the city needs to be queried about why that would be helpful, because it is a deviation from the current law and the way in which we treat loans with tax increments. And I don't know whether Senator Dibble had a similar provision, but I do think it's something a little bit out of the ordinary that I would advise the committee to pay attention to.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine doesn't, and I was looking at that. So
you
I'll
liked
bite.
It, I
I'll
bet, let, didn't you?
I like it. Maybe we should. So I'll bite. I'll ask the question. What would occur with the loan repayment proceeds? Would they go into a revolving account for future similar activities?
Yes, Senator. This would be a new account that eventually is going to just, you know, hopefully perpetual will keep being used for, for the help redeveloping houses and keeping Crystal in good shape. I think with the age of our stock, right now we're at the point where there is some deterioration, and if we can't keep the housing stock up, we all know where that leads to. So this would continue on in perpetuality for the 5 years. We would be using the money really on more construction projects that we could, the way the TIF district stands right now, where it's only for house replacement. My feeling is with the funds being used for remodeling, reconstruction, we can, probably work on 10, 15, 20 times more projects than we can the way it exists today.
Senator Dibble.
I don't know how the chair feels, but this bill is way more creative than my bill.
I should also have a vast expansion. Mr. Hoffman, thank you. Senator Rest, anything further?
Nope.
Thank you very much.
Chair lays over Senate File 3709 for possible inclusion in the committee bill.
Senator Rest. Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 3180.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I bring you the first engrossment of Senate File 3180, which has to do with an appeal, exceptions for the fiscal notes that we get from the Department of Finance and the revenue estimates from the Department of Revenue. As we are all only too familiar, those notes are estimates that are provided by the state agencies and then approved by the Department of Finance about the costs of proposed legislation. And those estimates are provided then also with from the Department of Revenue. According to NCSL, the National Conference of State Legislature, Minnesota is one of 11 states where fiscal notes are not prepared by legislative staff. One of 11 states where they're not prepared by legislative staff as opposed to by the administration's agencies. There are a variety of arrangements in other states in terms of the level of involvement by the legislature. Some of them including involving legislative approval of the final estimate. And in Minnesota, there is no formal process to handle disputes regarding cost estimates in that we get from either Department of Finance or the Department of Revenue. And in saying that, I want to make sure that for the most part, we are, I think the legislature appreciates the high quality of work that we get from the Department of Revenue and the Department of Finance, but there are those instances in which we would appreciate, I believe, a rare instance, it might even be, but a chance to challenge in a formal way the assumptions that go into those fiscal notes or the revenue estimates. And what Senate File 3180 does is to set up a process for legislators to appeal those estimates by, first of all, allowing a limited authority of a legislator, but only through the chairs of the Senate Tax Committee and the Senate Finance Committee, and in the House, the chair of the Senate Tax Committee and the chair of the Ways and Means Committee. The process would be for those folks to initiate an appeal that would be, in a sense, heard by or sent to the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy and to the Commissioner of Finance. The appeal itself, in the language that's before you, would have to identify the analysis that is being contested and the reasons for contesting the conclusions reached by those two state agencies. The commission itself must then meet within 5 days of receiving the appeal, and of course that's an arbitrary time, but it would seem to me that it would be possible to mount that appeal in within that time period. And at that point, any conclusions that would be reached by the commission would be considered the final estimate of the bill, as long as the fiscal elements remain unchanged. And we're familiar with those occasions where if an element in a bill is scalable, that the revenue estimate or the fiscal note changes as a bill goes through the process, and that is not what would be addressed through this proposal. We would expect that the process would be used very, very infrequently, but and we also know that disagreements on fiscal notes and revenue estimates are often resolved at a staff level by clarifying language clarifying either language or intent to make sure that we get the correct amount. But there are cases when that doesn't occur. And for those cases, it seems to be a reasonable position of the legislature to weigh in and have a way of appealing on those two infrequent occasions an estimate either from the Department of Revenue or the or the Department of Finance. And one would, when we look at the situations in other states where they really weigh in, they some of them even have a legislative budget office, and that has been talked about in Minnesota on occasion as well, to parallel what goes on in Congress with the Congressional Budget Office versus the Government Accounting Office, and that the legislature in a very formal way should offer its own budget. This is an extremely modest proposal to not go that distance, and in fact, I don't support that, and I think that states that have legislative budget offices and offer alternative budgets don't necessarily come up with a better budget process than the one we have here in Minnesota. However, where the governor proposes and the legislature disposes. However, it does seem to me that we should have an avenue to challenge on those very infrequent occasions a fiscal note, the assumptions that go into a fiscal note or a revenue analysis and to be able to have a say in that. In the that's what the bill does, and I would hope that you would be amenable to it. It needs to, if you are, it also needs to be held heard in the Committee on Finance.
We held out Section 3 and passed the fiscal note portion on to Finance. We held Section 3 here and had a discussion with the Department of Revenue about the revenue estimate.
Well, they are going to be testifying this morning. I think Mr. Manson, our commissioner, said he was coming forward today.
Okay.
I'd rather have the bill go not be separated, and they are prepared to tell you why they don't like it.
Commissioner?
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ward Ines, representing the Department of Revenue, and I just want to make a few comments about Section 3, which is the proposes an appeal process for revenue estimates. And though Senator Rest characterizes it as a modest proposal, I do think it breaks a long tradition we've had here in Minnesota. And I can only speak about the revenue estimates. I cannot talk about the fiscal notes that Finance does. But we, the department, previous commissioners, long line of respecting the integrity of the revenue estimating that goes on in the department. We keep a very strong firewall between the commissioner's office and Dr. Wilson's shop, who does the revenue estimates. It's always his call at the end of the day. We do have an informal forum for people to come in and when they want to question assumptions. What's our methodology? How do we arrive at that number? We're very open about that, and Dr. Wilson and his staff will come in and walk you through the methodology. If a taxpayer or an interested party has some different information, some different data they think is relevant, we're more than happy to look at that, and oftentimes we'll incorporate that data into our revenue estimate. So oftentimes this is a collaborative process. We don't just sit in our shop over at the Department of Revenue and come up with a number, and then there's no discussion thereafter, no dialogue. There is a dialogue. But I really want to – I don't know what the impetus for this was, if there was some concern about some of the revenue estimates that came out of the department. But we do. There is – it's been a long, long tradition that I was very respectful of, that the commissioner does not weigh in on revenue estimates. At the end of the day, it's Dr. Wilson's and the professional that's at the department's call. And to have an appeals process that goes in front of a legislative forum to make the final call on a controversial revenue estimate maybe – I think does set a precedent that I would have concerns about. Because I think the process has served us well under previous administrations and previous commissioners. And these revenue estimates, as you know, Chairman, I mean, they can – there's times when I don't agree 100% with the revenue estimate. But at the end of the day, we always defer to the professionals in the department. It's a very apolitical shop that Dr. Wilson runs. And I just think having an appeals process like this, even if it was used very selectively, and I don't see any parameters on this really. I mean, it could be used once or twice. It could be used 30 or 40 times. And we would be spending a lot of time in front of the Legislative Commission on Fiscal Policy debating methodology on revenue estimates. And I think that's a questionable way to go.
Senator Ress, don't you think this would require an awful lot of new discipline on the part of members? I mean, we see so many bill introductions come in late, and we don't expect the department or finance to issue a fiscal note or a revenue estimate until the bill's been scheduled for a hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they come in late. We hear them try to accommodate a member and hear it in a couple days. How would it work when generally we have a pretty fast timeline?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the call would be yours. If you if a member bringing a bill forward with a revenue estimate that you decide is, if you look at the it would be up to you to decide that to initiate an appeal from what the revenue estimate is that would come in. And again, this is not finding fault with any given revenue estimate that has come in the last 20 years. It is looking at what is the appropriate involvement of the legislature in the budget process with regard to the estimates that we get from the administration. It is not a reflection on a lack of professionalism. It is an acknowledgement that the legislature should play a role on occasion and to ask for sunshine, not just informal meetings in a room at the Department of Revenue or in your office, but to have those assumptions made on a particular revenue estimate that you would decide or the Senate Finance Chair would decide something from the Department of Finance on what kinds of assumptions have gone into the revenue estimate. It would not surprise me that even having initiated that on the rare occasions that I would expect it to happen because of the good judgment of our chairs, that the Commission on Fiscal Policy and Planning would uphold the department's estimate. But it is an opportunity for the legislature to weigh in, and it is an opportunity for there to be sunshine on the process. And perhaps if it's done even once and the chairs of the committees are satisfied to have that in a public discussion, that it would be even rarer.
Senator Rest, I'm very reluctant to send the revenue portion of this out over to Senator Cohen and turn that over to him, especially sensing the department's reluctance. Commissioner, I'm intrigued by the idea, and if we could set out kind of some kind of parameters, I think I'd like you maybe to take that message back to Dr. Wilson that if there's some kind of parameters under which we'd request that an opportunity to appeal, I think there's some merit in that. But it is pretty open-ended right now, I think.
Mr. Chairman, I do think it should be a public process. It should not be a process that occurs in a private meeting wherever it is, wherever it's done. Even if the tax committee itself was given some authority. I mean, at some point, there, I would maintain that the, again, at the macro policy level on how budgeting should work, what's the best way to go about budgeting? Having sunshine on the fiscal notes of the process now, not the result, but on the process of fiscal notes and revenue estimates seems to me to be a responsible position for the legislature to take. Also, I would direct your attention to the first section of the bill, which I went right to the other parts of it, and it does ask for a uniform procedure with regard to publishing the information that is the revenue estimates and fiscal notes that have been identified as a actually has been identified as an issue, and that we would ask for the Commissioner of Finance, and that's not in this committee, but nevertheless, the Commissioner of Finance to include a system for posting the date a fiscal note was requested, and you just mentioned that with regard to people that put bills in, request fiscal notes, and maybe it's more of a problem in the finance divisions than it is in the revenue committees. When the fiscal note was requested, when it was completed, the estimated completion date, as well as the display of those dates on the front page of each completed fiscal note. We also think that's a sunshine effort to give the best information in a timely fashion. If somebody requests a fiscal note on February 1st and they don't have it by by March 15th, then something's the matter. And it should be information that is available to us about why that happened, or to be able to question why that happened and why the fiscal note is not prepared.
Senator Ress, the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policy, they met just recently, actually.
Yes.
I'm trying to think, looking around the room, I think there are only two members on that are even serve on the Tax Committee in the House or the Senate, I think.
It is.
It's basically a spending group.
The original bill had the authority going to the Legislative Advisory Commission, and it was obviously way too partisan have this kind of authority reside solely with that group. The Fiscal Policy and Planning Group, people are on it ex officio for the most part. They're on it by virtue of their responsible role in the legislature, on the tax and finance committees. They're not on it simply because they are Democrats. They're on there because of the role they play in the legislature. And that's very different, and it's a far more appropriate group. And I understand that wanting maybe more tax people to be looking at that, but remember that the appeal would come only from you with regard to revenue notes. It would not come from, could not come in the Senate on revenue estimates from anyone else.
Senator Rest, I'd be more comfortable if the appeal was made on behalf of the chair and revenue had to come in front of the Tax Committee and justify their work.
I understand that as an alternative as well, except it then does narrow the role of the legislature as a whole in that appeal process. Keep in mind, again, in some other state, we're one of the 11 states that don't have a formal role for the legislature. But, you know, I'm bringing the idea forward. If you want to capture the tax part of that for further discussion, that's up to you and the committee.
I think we'd like to do that. And, Commissioner, I would like to have a discussion with Dr. Wilson's people about this, because I guess I think probably all of us have had questions about fiscal notes and revenue summaries.
But Mr. Chairman, again, I would request that if you do that, it be at a public hearing, not at a meeting in your office or Dr. Wilson's.
Senator
Rest,
I agree. I mean, I agree. I think if there's some language in here where that appeal could come back to be in front of the Tax Committee, and we could question the department about rationale, I think that's something that would be good input for this committee to have, I think.
Mr. Chairman, right now we just have to accept and trust. And what if we didn't have someone as professional as Dr. Wilson? What if we had someone whose decisions were more arbitrary? It's not a matter of personal trust of any given individual. It's a matter of having a system that ensures the greatest amount of information and the most deliberative judgment made on those occasions in which there is an appeal.
Commissioner?
Yeah, Chairman, I think your points are well taken about trying to find some parameters around this appeals process so it's not quite as wide open as maybe the current bill is drafted. I will say this. I know I've talked, alluded to our informal process where we're more than happy to meet with legislative analysts, you know, the people, the numbers crunchers, to go over a revenue estimate. But oftentimes there has been opportunities when we've come in front of committees and people have questioned our methodology on a revenue estimate, and we have shared and walked through our assumptions and the methodology, how we got to that, in a public forum in front of a tax committee. I'm also concerned about, from a revenue estimate standpoint, oftentimes there's revenue estimates that are done that if we go too, delve too far into the methodology and the assumptions, taxpayers can be identified. And so there's oftentimes, even in revenue estimates, we can't give all of our assumptions in that revenue estimate that we have because it will actually identify taxpayers, and we are very protective of that information. So I don't know if a public venue where you can actually appeal a revenue estimate is the most effective or most helpful way of doing it.
Mr. Chairman, it does not. If you look at lines 220, it is not wide open what you can appeal or what information can be revealed. Of course, there's data privacy with regard to the revenue estimates. What can be appealed is the analytical conclusions. What kinds of assumptions were made? There's no asking at that point for individuals to be identified. And we know that the times at which that becomes problematic are in some corporate income tax issues where major corporations, because of the industry sector that they're in, would be identified, and we're very protective of that. We're also very protective of identifying extremely wealthy individuals who would be identified if you only taxed the top 0.00001, we know exactly who those individuals would be, and we certainly don't ask for them to be identified. But a public discussion where the legislature not only receives information but has a role in determining the accuracy of the assumptions that go into the those revenue estimates seems to me to be appropriate and proper. And whether it's in the Planning Commission or whether it's in the Tax Committee, it's a role that we should aggressively pursue.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Admittedly, I'm more focused on the fiscal note side of this. I don't have anything specific to say other than I like this idea. Both sides, fiscal and revenue estimates. I do think you articulate some good issues that we may need to look at to avoid potential pitfalls around how much work we're creating and politicizing these sorts of things. But I think Senator Ress brings forward a very good idea that is modest and frankly maybe draws from some of the best practices of other states. Now, I'm not on the Finance Committee. I could get a little worked up over fiscal notes that I've received on proposals that I've had. I don't have similar critique of revenue estimates, but Senator Ress makes a good point. We may not have the best professional staff forever, and so a little scrutiny is warranted.
Senator Dibble, I'm a little nervous to send revenue estimates over to a bunch of finance chairs to decide if they're accurate, because I know the tendency of the finance chairs is to want to generate as much money as they can because they get to spend it. So I'm a little reluctant to do that. I think that's a forum better for the tax committees, whether we have a joint group of House and Senate tax panel members or I think there's some merit in the proposal. I just think the revenue estimates probably need to be treated differently than the fiscal numbers.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I do think that the sections of the bill should travel together, but I can understand that you would rather have more discussion over Section 3 in the bill and would not object to deleting it to retain the discussion here in the Tax Committee, but I would be very disappointed if the discussion ended with a deletion in the Tax Committee with the deletion of Section 3 from the bill.
Senator Scoy moves to delete Section 3. Members, and I am committed to having a discussion with revenue in front of this committee how we maybe could make something like this work. I mean, I think there's some merit to an appeal process. Dr. Wilson's not going to be around forever. I hope he's as here as long as I am, because he does run a very good shop over there. But
Mr. Chairman, I would like to request that when you have that discussion, that you invite me back to be a participant.
We'd be happy to.
Thank you.
On the motion to delete Section 3, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Contrary, no. Motion prevails. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Senator Rest, on line 1.17, the words "not otherwise resolved," I think that's too open. I think you need to have definition on what the dispute might be, because I think Senator Dibble hit on a point. For any of us, I think this is going to, we're going to have a problem with how many. I think everybody's going to have a problem with their fiscal notes and their revenue analysis. And the words "not otherwise resolved" means nothing.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Johnson, once again, this is not a process that I would expect to be like a runaway jury kind of thing. I mean, we have very responsible people as chair of our finance committees and or our tax committee, even though that section is now out of the bill and remaining here. And as I mentioned in my other comments, that a lot of the discussion and resolution when there is a disagreement between a member or a chair is resolved indeed informally in somebody's office, when somebody says, well, if we change the language here, would that clarify the intent of the bill in terms of the assumptions that you're using to bring forward the a fiscal note or a revenue estimate. And again, most of the time, or many times, they're not just on and off spigots for tax proposals. Many, many of them are scalable. And when someone gets a large revenue estimate or a small revenue estimate, when they want it to be the other way, scaling the proposal is often a solution to getting a revenue estimate that suits the overall fiscal policy in that bill. It's not just a matter of saying, I don't like the number. That's not the issue. The issue is to be able to challenge the analytical assumptions that go into the fiscal notes and the revenue estimates.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can we delineate a procedure, though, instead of saying not otherwise resolved?
Well, we have the procedure for the finance chair to make a determination that whatever disagreement over a fiscal note has arisen, that it has gone to the level that it can't be resolved unless there is a public discussion from the Department of Finance, giving the underlying assumptions, once again, the analysis that they're bringing forward that results in the fiscal note that the legislature has to live with without having a public way of discussing it. I mean, this is a macro policy. This is not, you know, ABC formula. It's not that. It's not intended to be that. And it's not intended to be used in that way.
Anything else, Board? Senator Dibble.
I was going to move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 3180, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance. Senator Johnson, on the motion.
Thank you. Not on the motion, Mr. Chair. On the point prior. The conversation about shedding light and sunshine and all that on the process, I'm just not knowing, you know, I think shedding light on exactly how to get to the appeals part is still important. I mean, we have to show that everybody involved did their best. You know, like they did step one, they did step two, they did step three, and now we can appeal. I'm just a little bit concerned that that isn't delineated in the bill.
Senator Johnson, I think that'll be something for Senator Cohen and his committee to work on. On the members of the Senate's under call, so we need to move along. On the Dibble motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Contrary, no.
Thank you.
Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Senator Stevens?
Can we do my testifiers are here?
Let's try as long as they're here.
Thanks, Senator.
But we are under call, so.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate File 1566 is a bill that we talked about last year. Actually, I'd like to first offer the A1 amendment, which addresses some of the concerns that the committee had last year. Speaking.
We did.
And I can explain it. Essentially, the bill, Senate File 1566, provides an exception to the general rule for modification by an authority of a tax increment financing plan when the modification is for the designation of additional property. And the amendment, which is being passed out, addresses some of the questions that were raised last year about public notice provisions. It requires that the acquisition that would be approved by the appropriate governing body take place in an open hearing in which public notices for the hearing have been published. And I can speak more to the bill.
Senator Stephen moves the A1 amendment. This is a public hearing process. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. Motion prevails. A1 is adopted. Senator Stephen on the amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With me today are Cheryl Jacobson and Andrea Brennan, both from the Dakota County CDA, who can speak to the bill if there are questions or if you'd like to take the time.
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Cheryl Jacobson. I'm with Dakota County Community Development Agency. Dakota County Community Development Agency is one of the largest providers of affordable housing in the state of Minnesota. We currently have nearly 1,200 units of affordable senior housing and 455 units of affordable workforce housing within our portfolio. This legislation is important to us because it allows agencies like ours to efficiently purchase sites for affordable housing developments. Affordable housing can be difficult to site. It requires appropriate zoning, availability of infrastructure, and affordable land, and time is typically of the essence when working on these projects. To identify property to be acquired with tax increment, current TIF law requires that the formal modification process be followed. This formal modification process is lengthy, usually adding 90 to 120 days to the entire process. It is also costly and often results in missed opportunities for affordable housing development. The proposed legislation amends the current law to allow a TIF authority to acquire land for affordable housing development through the administrative amendment process with the additional requirement of holding a public hearing by the governing body of the TIF authority. By following the administrative amendment process with the additional public hearing, The time is cut from that 90 to 120 days down to about 30 days' time. This allows development authorities such as the CDA to secure land for affordable housing in a more efficient manner. To move really quickly, Andrea Brennan with our office is here to provide an example of the impact that this legislation has on affordable housing development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The CDA created an affordable housing TIF district, which included budget authority to acquire property for an affordable senior building and an affordable workforce townhome development. Yep. Specific sites were not identified at the time the district was established. Once we identified a site for these projects, we went through the 120-day approval process, the formal modification process, to identify a parcel number in the TIF district. That was the only change we made to the TIF district, just adding a PIN number. The modification was approved by the CDA Board of Commissioners and the Dakota County Board of Commissioners. As part of the city development approval process for the actual project, several neighborhood meetings and public hearings were held. The outcome of this public process is that the city is supportive of the development. However, they don't like the site that we selected. They are supportive, and they are currently working with us to find an alternative site for this project. However, this will then require us to go back through the formal modification process of the TIF district solely to change the PIN number from one location to another. This 120-day approval process may prevent the project from starting in this construction season and delay it another year. In summary, this proposed legislation would only apply to properties that would be acquired for an affordable housing project, and only if the property were to be acquired under a voluntary sale situation. It would still require the governing body of the TIF authority to hold a public hearing before acquiring property. And unlike other changes that trigger the formal modification process, identifying property for acquisition doesn't affect the taxing jurisdiction in a financial way. This proposed legislation is also enthusiastically endorsed by NARO, as it affects other TIF authorities and affordable housing providers other than the Dakota County CDA. That Cheryl and I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Anything? Any members? Anything? Senator Sieben, anything further?
No, Mr. Chair.
Chair lays over Senate File 1566 as amended for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow morning, members, 8:30, we've got some additional members' bills. This committee's adjourned.